the duty of the working class, and the parliamentary representatives of, in the countries involved, members of the mass classes, in varying degrees, but with substantial forces, supported by the coordinating activity of the International Socialist Bureau, the leadership of the International, to exert every effort to prevent the outbreak of war by all the means that are most effective, which naturally vary according to the accentuation of the class struggle and the general political situation. If war nevertheless breaks out, it is their duty to intervene in favour of its speedy end and to do all in their power to utilise the economic and political crisis caused by the war to rouse the peoples and thereby hasten the abolition of capitalist class rule. They all voted for it. As Basel propositions reinforced it. Now, Lenin, as I say, had a hand, a substantial hand, in drafting that resolution, thought it was a marvelous resolution. Immediately afterwards, he wrote, the position adopted is rich in thought and precisely formulates the task of the working class, the most resolute and revolutionary action by the workers' parties internationally. It was an illusion, by the way. It was an illusion. But it is necessary to start from that illusion in order to understand that the events of August 1914 represented a fundamental break in the division, in the working class movement, more fundamental than anything before or since, more even than the arguments about the Russian Revolution, which I will come to later. That fundamentally, you know, the notion that in reality there was a big internationalist movement, and that it was possible for this movement, this powerful movement, actually, in the relatively short term, to transform the situation and so on, was an illusion. August 1914 was a shattering experience for serious internationalists. A shattering experience. What actually happened, as comrades know, actually, is that the leaders of the major socialist parties in the warring countries came to support not the most resolute struggle against imperialist war, etc., etc. They came to support, and indeed in the majority of cases, they actually joined governments pursuing imperialist war, and they savagely persecuted those of their followers, they had the power, who maintained what had been the line of the International. The German Social Democratic Party, and its parliamentary representatives, voted for war credits, voted therefore politically in effect to support the war. When this appeared in their central organ, their Berlin newspaper, Lenin, who by this time, he was in Galicia, part of the Austrian Empire, Polish ethnically, when he got a copy, his declaration was, immediately his reaction was, it is a forgery. It is a forgery by the German General Staff to spread confusion. He could not bring himself initially to believe that they would betray everything, but not just he, but they had said they stood for. And similarly with the French, the British and so on. Here's James Kearney, who was on the left, by the way, in the arguments about the anti-war struggle. He kept going on arguing we must cause an immediate general strike in, on the outbreak of war. Positions Lenin described as ultra-left and possible at all for various reasons. Actually, the British Labour Party supported the war and within 2 years were represented in the war cabinet. This enormous, shattering turnaround, the illusion that there was an international movement, a real international movement in the meaningful sense, was destroyed. And it is from that position that Lenin came to develop a fundamental criticism of all that had gone before, that he had supported. and therefore an entirely different view about what has to be done in the future. But it seemed very empty. What was Lenin's position? When he realised, actually, it is not a forgery, unfortunately, it is not a forgery. That really is the situation. His position was immediate. It is necessary to split from the social traitors, as he called them. It is necessary to split. The movement that we thought was actually a Marxist and revolutionary movement is led by opportunists, is led by traitors. It is necessary to split. It is necessary to build again from the beginning. Quite a not simply, but something we would have said, impossibilist position, because we should not have illusions, comrades. The great majority of the supporters of the social democratic parties in the various countries actually, for all sorts of reasons, actually supported their position of their leaders. When we talk about split, we are talking about a tiny minority. That is the first thing. We must split. Second thing is, we must characterise the war. We must tell it as it is. We must tell the truth. The leaders of the German party say the reason we support the war is if the Allies win, Russia wins, Tsarism, barbarism, the destruction of all the gains the German working class have made over the previous decades. Leaders of the British Labour Party said we must support the war because of the rape of Belgium, German imperialism, the Kaiser, the victory of the Kaiser represents a shift back for decades, European reaction and so on and so forth. And the French could say it with more conviction, at least they got as far as having a republic, which the British haven't yet, you know, democratic republic. And each and every national group produced a series of special arguments as to why it was necessary, critically or otherwise, to support, in quotes, their own government. Now that position had a logic of its own, of course, a supportive position, as I said earlier, that meant actually attempting to dragoon the working population in support of the war, to support repression against critics from the left and so on and so forth. Now the internationalists as a whole, it turned out, where we were the overwhelming majority, unanimous, a handful. Two things, therefore. First of all, characterize the war. I don't want to inflict long quotations on our heads, but this one is central. This was Lenin's first analysis, first political statement, as opposed to the fact that they are traitors. You know, this is the basis of internationalism today, i.e. in 1914. First, the war is an imperialist war. The war is being waged by the different ruling classes to struggle for control of various parts of the world to redivide the colonial empires. Colonial policies have brought about the almost complete partition of the globe. The essence of this war is a struggle between ruling classes for a repartition. It is totally reactionary. And then he goes on to say, world capitalism's productive forces have outgrown the limited boundaries of national and state divisions. And the objective conditions, therefore, are right for socialism to be achieved in the imperialist war is ushering in the era of social revolution. All the objective conditions of recent times have put the proletarian revolutionary mass struggle on the order of the day. It is the duty of socialists, whilst making use of every means of the working class's legal struggle, he was not to that, you see, whatever legal opportunities there are, to subordinate each and every one of these means to the immediate and most important task, to subordinate them. develop the workers' revolutionary consciousness, rally them in the international revolutionary struggle, promote and encourage any revolutionary action, and do everything possible to turn the imperialist war between states into a civil war for the expropriation of the oppressed classes against their oppressors. A war for the expropriation of the capitalist class for the conquest of political power by the proletariat and the realization of socialism. In all the advanced countries, the war has placed on the order of the day the slogan of socialist revolution. The conversion of the present imperialist war into a civil war is the only correct policy. That position was received by hardly anyone. In fact, you could say it sounded like a spell. But by 1915, there was the beginnings of the development of opposition in the major imperialist countries. This opposition is very important to us. We need to look at its political character. It had three components. First of all, let's look at its actual organisational form. The Italian government, Italian imperialism, for a whole number of reasons, had not yet committed itself to one side or the other in 1950. It was to do so the next year, in calculation, very simple way. And therefore it was possible for the leaders of the Italian Socialist Party to go on repeating the slogans of Stuttgart and Basel and so on, because they weren't put to the test yet, were they, you see? And of course, it was also possible for the Socialist Party, dear, neutral, cuckoo clock man in Switzerland, also to repeat, because they were not put to the test, to fight the Swiss bourgeoisie, to maintain a formally internationalist position. These two parties, both significant affiliates of the international, called a congress. It was held at Simmerlach in Switzerland, a Chinese ski resort, and their appeal, the appeal by two big, one big and one significant party, met a very, very small response. There is this lovely quotation, it's from Trotsky actually, but I can't resist it. If I can find it, and if I can't, I'll paraphrase it. I think I can find it. Well, what's on that page, I can't. The delegates! There wasn't a railway like Simmerlach, it wasn't important to make. So they then, the delegates, filled four stagecoaches, filled with horses, set off for the mountains. I told you it was a ski resort. Passers-by looked on curiously at the strange procession. The delegates themselves joked about the fact that half a century after the founding of the First International, it was still possible to seat all the internationalists in four stages. The notion of the relationship of forces. There were, in fact, approximately 40 of us. But, and this is very, very important in understanding how Lenin's ideas developed, amongst this group of people who were willing to attend an international conference, often illegally. After all, the war is on, it's treason to talk to Germans if you're French or Belgian, and vice versa and so on, and the British, of course. They couldn't get out at all because the British government takes advantage of the fact that you're an island here, we can't get out without a passport, there was no British representation. These 40 actually represented the extreme left wing of European social democracy. However, in their great majority, they were not prepared to accept what were for Lenin the two fundamental considerations. The first was the break, the split with social democracy, with the traitors, the recognition. August 1914 represents a fundamental divide in the road, that those who have gone one way are lost, they are part of the class enemy, it is necessary to start again and so on. On the contrary, they were concerned to do two things. First of all, the argument, peace by negotiation. You know, we must persuade pressure there, of course, it's a very familiar argument, but at the end of the day,
the imperialist dragging tooth and claw and all the rest of it must be persuaded to accept a peace without annexations, without indemnities, etc., etc. They must be persuaded, not overthrown. Secondly, the means whereby this is to be done is the recreation of the international, the broad international, which collapsed in 1914. Bolsheviks found themselves in a minority. Very small minority, actually. Truth is, the delegations of the Zimmerfeld left, there were eight of them, to be precise. Two Bolsheviks, who represented something real, in Russia at least, and six other people, who represented precious little. Anyway, right? The majority who did represent something, they represented what I would call the centrist anti-war position, were quite willing to subscribe to a general denunciation of imperialism and war. And did. It was written by Trotsky. Even Trotsky at that time would not accept the line of the thing I read out, imperialist war, turn the imperialist war into a civil war, and so on. Actually, they produced a statement which we would describe today as a typical Soviet statement. They deplored the horrors of war, etc. They called for negotiations between the powers. They called for peace. The world demands peace, etc., etc., etc. That, remember, was the extreme left. The extreme left of the movement in Europe. You think we're isolated? The isolation of Lenin and Zinoviev, who is representative of the communist, was vastly, vastly greater. They have six supporters, not one of whom represented an organisation that was more than a Tuckney Hakeney organisation. All the real forces, either with the chauvinist right, the great majority, or with the pacifistic, stoddy, confused CND type. All right, we'll say something about this. Nevertheless, even that soggy, confused left was very important for the fact. You know? Zinoviev, Lenin was not a delegate. With the full support of Lenin, nevertheless voted for the soggy resolution. Lenin wrote afterwards in defense of this, in the given circumstances, any declaration against the war by significant social democratic forces represents a step forward. It would be, he said, sectarianism for us to refuse to take this step. But at the same time, they insisted on publishing their own defeated by all the books to make, resolution which contains the central things. Break decisively with the Second International. Break decisively with the social traitors. We know now they are not on our side. The British Labour Party is actually a bourgeois, an instrument of bourgeois class rule, of white working class, basic working class. The SNA in Germany is exactly the same. Break with that. First. Secondly, not peace by negotiations between the imperialist bandits, Lenin's expression, not mine, at the moment of these picturesque things, but rather revolutionary struggle everywhere, wherever possible, and by whatever means possible. Important to make the point, Lenin, as I say, was not an ultra-left. That did not mean that he thought those people in Germany who sympathised with him, or actually, to somehow or other get hold of a pistol or something, or a bomb, and go out and shoot the first soldier they could see, or blow up a police station. No, no, no. It's a question of that movement. Politically, let's break it up for that. There was a subsequent conference at Kintar, which I will not go into, at which essentially the same thing was repeated. But in Kintar in 1916, it was in some ways different. Why was it different? Because the impact of the war upon millions and tens of millions was, by this time, being different. There was mass enthusiasm for the war in 1914, you know. Amongst working people, there was mass enthusiasm. Read the accounts. 1916, you think about it. A series of events. Fedor,
the Somme, the Brusilov offensive, the massive slaughter, the incredible slaughter. I don't know how many comrades saw this. July 1st, 1917 was the beginning of the Somme offensive by the British with some French support. In the course of that battle, the British army, by its own figures, lost suffered 430,000 casualties. Can you imagine the magnitude? 430,000 in a few weeks. The French, by their figures, 180,000. The German defenders, by their figures, 395,000. And all in an area less than 40 miles long and 3 miles wide. The immense slaughter. Better, the slaughter was even greater. Brusilov offensive in Galicia, even worse, broke the back of the Russian army. The enormous casualty rates, first. Secondly, the increasing economic difficulties, increasing economic stringencies, radicalization on a simple anti-war basis, the demand for peace. Now, the demand for peace, of course, has to be articulated by someone, and it was the very sort of people who Zimmerfeld and Kinkel had argued, you know, negotiations and so on. They were there. They were typically deputies, members of parliament, etc., etc. They were among us. And so, this group of so-called sockies, actually representing very little in 1950, and standing out there, that's all right. 1916, began to feel the groundswell. Well, of the earth of support. And of course, there were a number of important events. First of all, the Dublin Rising. The Dublin Rising. The vast majority, Eastern, the vast majority of social democrats, left as well as right, condemned as an adventure. For Lenin, it was marvellous. It was the first stroke of lightning through the dark skies. And to those people who said, come on, these are Irish nationalists. Many of them are papists, religious, superstitious, and petty bourgeois, and so on. They look, those who expect to see a pure revolution will never live to see it. This heroic struggle must be, you know, distinguishes between those who are serious, when we talk about turning the imperialist point to a civil war, and those who merely talk. There was also substantial writing in Russian Central Asia, writing of Turkish speaking peoples and so on. The situation on a world scale was changing. Actually, of course, it was changing more than even Lenin and Co. recognized. Because February 1917, very much later, less than a year after the Dublin Rising, the Russian army broke, effectively disintegrated. The February Revolution occurred. Now, the impact of the February Revolution on Europe was enormous. Was enormous. The situation both in Germany and in Britain, less so than in France, but still, well, important exception, Germany and Britain, there were large-scale demonstrations. There were strikes which had a big scale, which had a formally economic content, for which, as Lenin said, they are real strikes for peace. All, of course, illegal. All against the established leaderships, the trade union leaderships, Labour, Social Democrats, and so on, scandalous, you're helping the Germans, you're helping the British, go back to work, German agents, British gold, all this stuff, yes. Actually, it is the break, it is the beginnings of the real break. And of course, the impact of the October Revolution a few months later was enormously greater. The turn the imperialist war into a civil war slogan, which in 1914-1915 had seemed utterly unrealistic, Trotsky said that actually, utterly unrealistic, now began to take on certain elements of reality. And it is in this connection that we must discuss the problem of what Lenin called the sentence. Now then, look here. When in 1915 there's only a handful of us willing to stand up against the war on any basis, even a Christian pacifist basis,
actually you don't quarrel too hard with your allies. You say actually you're wrong, you're soggy, you're but still with all your resolution, it's a step forward. But under the conditions of 1917-1918, the situation is transformed. There is a real revolt, a real mass revolt. And a certain, not saying there are strikes, political implications of this. You take the most important case, Germany. In the spring of 1917, German Social Democratic Party split. Actually, what that meant was that the right moved in and expelled the pacifistic, confused, and so on left. They formed the Independent Party. That party began to grow enormously and very, very rapidly. You see, because of the extreme tensions in German society, of the growth of hatred of the war, the casualty lists, the food shortages, and so on and so forth, grew very, very rapidly, and continued to grow for the next 2-3 years. In France, there were very large-scale mutinies in the French army in the summer of 1917, a similar phenomenon. The French Socialist Party, which had supported the war, waving the tricolour, you know, you can always do this left-wing support for reactionary causes, Robespierre, the Convention, the 14 armies of the Republic, I don't know whether you know the rhetoric, but you know, the appeal to 1793, in support of the cause, naturally, nearly diametrically opposite, but nevertheless have been very effective. Actually, course of 1917, the right wing lost control, and they were replaced, not by Bolsheviks, but by the confused, the left, the zombies. So there is a general lesson here, too, comrades, isn't it? Huh? This is what happened in Russia itself. Come on. Early 1914, insofar as there were political organisations with real support, the Bolsheviks dominated the Russian working class. After February 1917, it dominated a layer of class-conscious, fairly politically conscious workers. Yes? After February, what happened? Why? An enormous mushrooming of support for the SRs, who had the Socialist Revolution, had the great advantage of not standing for anything definite, and therefore being able to appeal to all kinds of people, exactly as in Portugal, you know. Flowers at the end of the rifles, the soggies grow, which is marvellous, actually, is marvellous and progressive, provided we understand clearly that that represents a radicalisation, and that it is necessary to distinguish very, very clearly between the progressive aspirations of their newly risen supporters, newly risen to consciousness, supporters who actually have revolutionary aspirations, in the sense that they want a new world and their leaderships. The problem, therefore, was to fight now against the centrists and at the same time, after the October Revolution, centrally important, the question of carrying the revolution in Europe forward. I'll digress for a little bit. Comrades will know, or maybe not, but at any rate. In April 1917, Lenin abandoned the position, the political position he had held since 1903, and particularly since 1905, about the nature of the Russian Revolution. I won't spend time on it, so dispute it, not that we'll deal with that afterwards, I think. And accepted the perspective and persuaded his party, which was very reluctant, to accept the perspective that the immediate object is workers' power. Again, I repeat, not along to the left, not in the sense of, you know, we're a minority at the minute, that we can simply achieve it by saying so, but that is the strategic aim towards which we are supporting. We do not give critical support to the revolutionary, so-called revolutionary government, or became Kerensky in the end. Actually, we seek to overthrow it and replace it by the power of workers organized in Soviet workers' councils and so on. An essential part of that perspective was, of course, the revolution in the rest of Europe. Rest of Europe. A revolution in a number of advanced countries in Europe. An essential part of that perspective. Because of course, Lenin had argued previously, and he's not changed his argument for this, the objective conditions for workers' power and the achievement of socialism in Russia as such do not exist. That had been his position. He didn't change it. What he changed his perspective because he saw the rising tide of struggle in Europe.
Now, the most important thing for us to understand is he was not mistaken. He was not mistaken. I quote from a man who cared actually, I think, he had fascists, but who, under the conditions of great radicalization at the time, is a German speaking, Hungarian, you know, middle class and what have you, was swept along for a moment, not for a moment, 7 years into the communist movement. He's a reactionary, a fellow called Borkenau, doesn't matter. Here he is telling what he actually saw, because he was there, that way, and he does it very, very specifically. January 1918.